Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1214, I will have two segments. First, we will listen to some of the remarks delivered at a press conference organized by the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, unveiling a new Iran policy report titled The Pitfalls of Operation Epic Fury. And during the second segment, I will air the remarks delivered at a press conference organized by Doctors Against Genocide on Palestinian political hostages held in Israeli prisons. On April 17, 2026, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, a national policy and advocacy organization in the United States that works to advance justice, equity, and inclusion for American Muslims, released a new policy paper on the war on Iran titled The Pitfalls of Operation Epic Fury, How the Undeclared War Against Iran Hurts Americans' Interests Abroad and at Home. Several speakers participated at that press conference, and I'm going to share now the remarks of Salam Al-Mariati, President of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, Samir Hussein, MPAC's Managing Director, Harry Stern, MPAC's Vice President of Policy and Programming, and the remarks of the guest speaker, Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Misal Irfan, Policy Communications Manager at MPAC.
Today, as I said, the Muslim Public Affairs Council is releasing a new policy paper, which is titled The Pitfalls of Operation Epic Fury, How the Undeclared War Against Iran Hurts American Interests Abroad and at Home. This press conference and essentially briefing will outline our key findings, the broader context of the current U.S.-Iran escalation, and obviously more urgent policy recommendations that we're putting forward. At its core, the report makes a pretty clear argument that this is already undermining U.S. strategic interests, destabilizing the region, and of course, imposing real costs on everyday Americans here at home. We're witnessing the early signs of what could become another open-ended conflict, one with pretty profound humanitarian consequences abroad and serious civil liberties implications domestically, which we'll unpack a little bit more. The report also documents a pretty concerning trend of the normalization and dehumanizing rhetoric toward Iranians, Muslims, and other communities across the country, which is coinciding with a rise in hate-filled violence and discrimination here in the United States. So these dynamics are not separate, and what we're trying to really convey here today is that it's all directly connected. I want to start off by introducing Salam Al-Mariati, the president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He will sort of set the stage for what we're going to discuss today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Salah. What we are witnessing today is a deeply dangerous moment, and I hope that our paper can frame a discussion both at the national level and in local communities on the consequences, the costs, the repercussions of war, and how we can find alternatives to war in achieving American interests, U.S. national interests. A war with Iran, whether led by the United States or in coordination with Israel, would not make America safer. It would repeat the same strategic, moral, and political failures we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, only on a much larger and more volatile scale. We've heard the story before. Before the Iraq War, senior officials assured the American public that the invasion would be quick, easy, and even welcomed. I remember watching Paul Wolfowitz on TV saying that Iraqis would greet U.S. forces as liberators, essentially with flowers. We are repeating the same tragedy today. And what's worse, Wolfowitz disparaged anyone who disagreed with him. So instead of flowers, we saw years of insurgency, massive civilian suffering, trillions of dollars spent, and long-term instability that continues to shape the region today. The lesson is clear. Wars sold with certainty often produce anti-American sentiment, both regionally and globally. There are no security gains in these wars. And we have to be honest about another reality. War in the Middle East has consistently radicalized the region, and it is doing so again. The U.S. introduced militias in Iraq to gain control of a destabilized country, and cycles of violence fueled extremism, not eliminated it. Military escalation created grievances, deepens anger, and provides recruitment narratives for further violence. If the goal is long-term security, war has repeatedly proven to be counterproductive. And yet we are told that there is no money for basic needs here at home. We hear political leaders say that the country cannot afford investments like childcare or daycare for working families. But when it comes to war, There is always funding, billions for new conflicts, trillions spent on past ones. And Senator Bernie Sanders tried to block funding for more war last night. He failed, yet now we see 40 senators opposing this funding of the war, whereas before it was only a handful. So the contrast is not just frustrating, it reflects a profound misalignment of national priorities. The American people never gave their consent to this war, and Congress has failed in its constitutional duty by refusing to engage in the debate required to authorize it. We also need to confront a deeper contradiction in how we talk about security. U.S. counterterrorism policy has often singled out Muslims as the primary source of global terrorism. But when we look at the scale of violence in the Middle East, the reality is stark. The number of civilians killed in military operations in Gaza and the broader region far exceeds the toll attributed to many of the groups used to justify these policies. This does not diminish the reality of terrorism, which must always be condemned and applied consistently. Civilian life must be valued equally, regardless of who is responsible. If we ignore that principle, we undermine our moral credibility and fuel further instability. The consequences of war also comes home. Dehumanizing rhetoric stays confined to foreign policy. Doesn't stay confined to foreign policy. It shapes how communities are treated domestically. Expanding surveillance of Muslims or treating entire communities as a suspect will not make us safer. We learned after 9/11 that these approaches eroded civil liberties and weakened trust, which is essential for real security. At the same time, campaigns that portray Islam or Sharia as threats are fuel for more war and policies of confrontation. They marginalize Muslim voices, especially those speaking out against war, and suppress legitimate dissent. When voices calling for diplomacy are silenced, the path to conflict becomes easier. And so this paper lays out a better path. If we truly want to support the Iranian people, we should stop policies that impoverish them. Broad-based sanctions have not produced democracy, as Trita Parsi, one of the most renowned experts on Iran, has stated. They have practically eliminated the middle class, strengthened hardliners, and harmed ordinary citizens. Lifting sanctions would empower civil society, expand economic opportunity, and allow the Iranian people to shape their own future. Real change comes from within societies, not from bombs dropped from above. And finally, we must remember the most important lesson from Iraq and Afghanistan. Military force cannot impose stability or peace. Those wars were built on flawed assumptions and promises of quick success. Instead, they left behind instability and diminished U.S. credibility. We cannot afford to repeat those mistakes. The choice before us is clear. We can continue down a path of escalation, fear, and war, or we can choose diplomacy, accountability, and investment in our own people. Rejecting war with Iran, lifting sanctions that harm civilians, protecting civil liberties here at home, and applying consistent moral standards abroad is not weakness. It is the only path to real security. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Salam, for that critical contextualization of this moment right now. I want to pass now the mic to Samir Hussain, the new managing director at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, who will get us a better understanding of the key findings of the report and sort of helping us draw that connection of course, whatever is happening in Iran is harmful to the U.S., but how does this impact the American Muslim community and Americans at large?
Thank you, Misal, and good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank you all for joining IMPACT's virtual press conference today. So we are discussing the release of our Iran policy paper, as Salam just introduced, and some of the key objectives with this initiative and some of our key findings. I also want to note that we're releasing a community guide, which further highlights what MPAC is doing to advocate for the interests of the American people in the context of Operation Epic Fury. And so I'll do a bit of a recap of the paper as well to highlight a few more items here. And I also want to reflect a little bit about why we're doing this paper. As an American Muslim organization, we're advocating on behalf of engaged American citizens. We care about the same issues that all Americans care about. We want everyone to be safe, and we want everyone to thrive so they can reach their full potential. And MPAC is acutely aware of how the voices of American Muslims are often left out in these conversations, which Salam did mention, and on important national issues that affect each and every American. So with that framing, I'll get into the Iran policy paper. First and foremost, this war is top of mind for American Muslims, as it is for Americans across the board. Our country is engaged in a war that we feel that Americans had no say in, and at the same time, everyone is feeling the impacts of this war right here at home in real time. So we feel compelled to say something just on that basis. But as another important matter, as an American Muslim advocacy organization, we're always exploring ways that we can offer constructive policy recommendations to better reflect the interests of the American people. In the context of the Iran war, we want to contribute to the pursuit of a lasting peace to promote security globally and right here at home, and advance economic prosperity for everyone, which has become a key issue in this context. So as we lend our perspective to this important conversation, we are doing more than just observing a problem set. We are offering 10 concrete, actionable policy recommendations. And MPAC will continue to do its part to engage government officials at all levels and our partners to implement these recommendations. And most importantly, as I mentioned before, we want to empower everyday Americans. So we're excited to launch a community guide on this topic to help enable just that. So diving into the paper, I'll start with our key findings and observations. This is just going a little bit deeper into what the paper is about, and that conversation will continue after my overview. The first theme we identified relates to the global situation. After doing an analysis of the consequences of the military strikes in Iran and across the region, we are expressing concerns about getting embroiled in another forever war, which no American wants. We note in the paper that if there is a reversion to hostilities, it could easily turn into a costly, open-ended military commitment for the U.S., which replicates the patterns identified earlier in the decades-long wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And based on that assessment, we highlight two points. One is that a full-scale war would have a much greater human cost for civilians throughout the region, which has not been discussed in any meaningful way. And that's why we wanted to highlight that in the paper and in our discussion today. And secondly, and this is something that concerns all of us, that a full-scale war could put American service members directly in harm's way indefinitely. The second theme is closer to here, right here at home. And that's how everyday Americans are again in the crosshairs. And many of you are familiar with the economic impact that Americans are facing when they were already struggling to make ends meet. On top of that, MPAC has highlighted many of the findings in terms of the impact on the American Muslim community. In the lead up to and following the military strikes in Iran and the surrounding region, MPAC has documented a significant spike in anti-Muslim sentiment and increased attacks against Muslims across America. And we're actually going to go deeper into that during our conversation today. And then we also want to note that if we can go off of what's happened in the past, we know that conflicts in the Middle East have resulted in an expansion of US government surveillance, suspension of civil liberties, asset seizures without due process, and degradation of civil society. So we want to encourage everyone to be aware of that possibility and for our elected officials to do everything to protect everyone's civil liberties in this time of heightened tensions. And then I'd like to quickly give an overview of the policy recommendations in our paper. And those are, again, in those two broad themes. They're the foreign policy elements of all of this, but then it actually ties it directly to our domestic considerations. So first and foremost, MPAC calls for the end to the war through multi-stakeholder diplomacy to secure a lasting peace. We really think this is the way to address all of the shortcomings that we're going to be identifying both in the paper and our discussion today. The next few recommendations will really highlight the importance of diplomacy, rejecting military escalation, and we really want to put a finer point on the human cost of all of this, and we call for humanitarian assistance and to lift broad-based sanctions to alleviate that human suffering on the ground. Going to the domestic piece of this, we do want to put a finer point on protecting civil liberties and rejecting any of that post 9/11 style surveillance practices or expanding unchecked law enforcement authorities that target American Muslims and, of course, Iranians, Arabs, and members of other affected communities. And then we will be getting into a deeper discussion today about addressing the significant spike in anti-Muslim and other forms of hate-fueled violence and bigotry in the context of this war. So with that, I appreciate you bearing with me as I give you a quick overview, and I'd now like to turn it back to Misal. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Samir. It's essential that we not only give you sort of the policy recommendations, but also highlight what we're going to do with them. And we want to ensure that this isn't a paper that we're just adding to the ether of many policy reports and breakdowns of what's happening, but we want to have actionable recommendations that we can take via our government impact team to Congress and on the Hill to ensure that these changes are actualized in Congress. Now, I would like to introduce our guest speaker, Trita Parsi. It was really essential for us to have an Iranian-American voice and one that represents many of the views of individuals that are directly impacted by what's been happening over the last couple of weeks. To sort of give you an insight, many of you know who Trita is, but I want to give you his background. He is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. He is an expert on U.S.-Iranian relations, Iranian foreign policy, and the geopolitics of the Middle East. He has authored 4 books on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East with a particular focus on Iran and Israel. He has been named by the Washingtonian Magazine as one of the 25 most influential voices on foreign policy in DC for 5 years in a row since 2021, and preeminent public intellectual Noam Chomsky called Parsi one of the most distinguished scholars on Iran. So I'd like to welcome Trita, and this will essentially be a conversation between Trita Parsi and MPAC's Vice President of Policy and Programming, Haris Turan.
Thank you, Misal. I appreciate your leading of the conversation. And thank you, Trita, for joining us this afternoon for this conversation.
Thank you.
You know, I just wanted to kind of lay out real quickly why we thought it was important for us to contribute to this conversation. We know that everyone is talking about Iran right now, not just in the United States, but in Europe, in the Middle East, around the world. We know that there's been conversations in Islamabad and Pakistan over the past couple of weeks of how to bring the parties together and how to find a solution and a resolution moving forward. But I think it was really important that we highlight that this war was a war of choice. It was a war of choice that was a strategic mistake made by Washington, D.C. It was not brought upon the American people, but now the American people are having to bear the consequences of this war. And not just the American people who are feeling it in higher gas prices and higher fertilizer prices and higher grocery prices, but also now that the rest of the world is looking at America and questioning its leadership, its place in the world, and its strategic thinking and strategic decision-making in engaging the rest of the world. So this has not only brought actual economic harm to our nation, but it's brought reputational harm to the U.S., and a harm that is probably going to take years, if not decades, to reverse. And so we just wanted to have a conversation with you, Trita, about not only the domestic harm, of course, that it's causing us as Americans, but also the reputational harm that this is going to cause our nation moving forward and our ability to lead like some of us actually want America to do. And the first question I'll ask you, Trita, is everybody's paying attention to what's happening. Pakistan is taking the lead, and the White House essentially said yesterday that Pakistan will continue to take the lead, and they'll be the only country that will really speak to the different parties and bring them together. Can you give us a brief update as to where we are? What are some insights that you might have that might give our audience the ability to understand in a bit more nuanced manner where the two parties are, and if they're any closer today than they were last week of actually coming to a resolution?
Thank you so much, Haris, and it's a great pleasure to be with MPAC, and I'm very appreciative of the report that MPAC has produced, not just its call for an end to the war, this unjust war, this war of choice, but also because of the call for the lifting of sanctions, because of the suffering that has imposed on the Iranian people. It is quite fashionable in Washington to take the side of the Iranian people, but only when it comes to imposing some punitive measures that are ostensibly aimed at the government, even though the impact of those measures tend to be most felt by the population. So we have been punishing the Iranian people in the name of helping them for decades now. And it's the only way to actually help them is to alleviate the pressure that they have been put under by these economic difficulties as a result of the sanctions, in order to empower them to be able to take their fate in their own hand and push back against the repression of the government. So to see MPAC coming out with that very clear call, I think, is very, very welcome. As to the question of the negotiations themselves, hopefully there will be another round of talks in the next couple of days in Pakistan and Islamabad. The two sides have moved a bit closer to each other through the exchanges of messages and the ongoing negotiations that are taking place between the actual summits. And some of those negotiations are also expressed through all these kinds of threats that are being made, whether it is moving more U.S. troops to the region or whether it is this talk of a blockade. All of that, I think, should be understood as measures taking place within a negotiation. But it is still very difficult to get a deal, not because the parties cannot achieve it. It is achievable, but it will require not only a tremendous amount of political will from both sides, but it will also require that President Trump says no to the Israeli prime minister, because any deal will require significant sanctions relief for Iran as in exchange for major concessions on the Iranian side on the nuclear front and on other issues. But from the Israeli standpoint, the worst scenario is not just that the war ends, but that the US actually strikes a deal and lifts these sanctions. Because the Israelis want to see sanctions be on Iran in a prolonged way to slowly but surely degrade the country's industrial base and capacity. War, of course, does that in a shorter and more intense ways, but sanctions do it in a very, very systematic and long-term way. And the Israelis are going to push back very, very hard against the lifting of sanctions. The question then, of course, will be if Trump can actually get a really attractive deal with major nuclear concessions, something that he can objectively say is better than Obama's nuclear deal, will he take it and say no to the Israeli prime minister? Or is he disinclined to confront the Israeli prime minister and as a result reject a deal that otherwise would clearly serve U.S. national interests but also be very helpful to the Iranian people?
Thank you for that overview, Trudeau. I want to bring us back to the U.S. and an interesting phenomenon that is now taking place as a result of this war of choice by the Trump administration. There has been fissures that have come out of this war as it pertains to even the president's own coalition at this moment. You have folks like Tucker Carlson. You have folks who are like Candace Owens and others on the right who have essentially churned on MAGA and the president as a result, really, of this war and also as a result of the last 2 years of genocide in Gaza. But then you have some folks who are doubling down in support of the president. And then in poll after poll, Americans are saying that they are against this war, that this war is not a popular war. I would love to get your reflections on, number one, is the American public and our American policymakers and opinion shapers finally turning the page and going to be continuing to push back against this war? Will there be enough leverage domestically to say we cannot continue this war? Will it become an issue in the 2026 elections and even potentially in the 2028 elections when Vice President Vance will be wanting to run or Marco Rubio? Can you talk to us a little bit about this coalition that has fallen apart? And has Iran been really the core of this division?
Thank you, Aris. Yes, this coalition has experienced some significant internal contradictions and problems as a result of Trump essentially betraying several of his different promises. It's not just Iran, it's also what happened to the Epstein files. As you remember, he did promise that he would release them. And we saw a tremendous amount of anger within the MAGA coalition over his betrayal on that issue. And then on top of that, he's now betraying another promise that he would be the president that would not start new wars. He's already started several wars, but they have ended up being relatively short affairs. And as a result, he could get away with saying these were not wars, these were just military operations. He's not been able to do that with Iran, obviously. It's been going on for 6 weeks. It's just a ceasefire. It could potentially restart. And this has really angered a lot of people in that coalition because they actually took these ideas and principles seriously. They were not just part of a cult that would follow Trump wherever he went. And that's why you have a bit of a differentiation between those who call themselves America First and those who call themselves MAGA. America First is more precise. It is more specifically focused on the foreign policy aspects of this, in which, in their view, the United States should put its own interests first in all of its decisions instead of ending up getting dragged into wars by other countries that serve those countries but do not serve U.S. interests. And the Iran war, particularly with the administration itself admitting that they started it because Israel was about to attack Iran, is the textbook's case of the United States entering into war or going along with a war that did not serve its interests but was at the behest of another country. Now, if Trump manages to end this war, and I think part of the reason why he agreed to the ceasefire is precisely because of the dire political consequences it would have had he not managed to get a ceasefire. But if he doesn't, if he ends the ceasefire, or if he doesn't manage to stay out of this war again, then I think this is going to be a major issue in the midterms. It still probably will be. But Trump can still minimize that impact by ending this war. And it's part of the reason why I think he's being somewhat serious about negotiations. Because he nevertheless managed to end it before oil prices had gone up so high for such a long period that you would see really long-lasting rise in gas prices. We only have at this point mainly a bottleneck problem, not a production problem of oil in the Persian Gulf, which means that oil prices can come down relatively quickly if the chokehold is open, the Strait of Hormuz. Whereas if you had the war continue and the infrastructure of oil had been targeted, then you would have on top of that a production problem that would make oil go up higher, but also in a long-term way. And that would be devastating for Trump to, politically. So I think his own political instincts have pushed him far enough to get a ceasefire. Whether it will push him far enough to get a deal remains to be seen.
And now moving to the Iranian people. In Washington, everyone claims to speak for the Iranian people or know what the Iranian people actually want. Whether it's Lindsey Graham who tweets out, this is what the Iranian people want, whether it's Ted Cruz or whether it's Reza Pahlavi, the son of the former Shah of Iran. Everyone claims that the Iranian people either want this or do not want this, that they are doing this for the sake of the Iranian people. And the Iranian people have, of course, multiple times come out onto the streets and spoken up. But can you give us an analysis of what is it that the Iranian people or the sentiment, the general sentiment of the Iranian people, as it pertains to, of course, their own human rights and their civil rights, but also as it pertains to foreign intervention and whether they actually want a foreign intervention to change their basic conditions or their governance structures? We would love to hear, what is it that the Iranian people want in a general sense? And why do people continue to speak on behalf of the Iranian people?
Thank you, Haris. Well, obviously, a country of 93 million will have a diversity of views. There is no one such thing as one Iranian opinion. And those who have been pushing the idea that the Iranians all wanted the U.S. military to come and, in their words, liberate them, may have spoken for a small but loud group of Iranians inside of Iran and as a larger group, but not a majority of Iranian Americans in the US who pushed for this line, which was a rather surprising development, I have to say, since support for war within the Iranian American community has been less than 5% for most of the last 20 years. The fact that it went up to 48% or so is in and of itself a very significant development, but it was not a majority. And by now, at least as of 2 weeks ago, when it became clear that this is not a war on the regime, this is a war on the country, a war that is destroying its infrastructure, killing its innocent people, killing school children, destroying universities, destroying power plants, creating environmental crisis, then we saw that the support for the war started to plummet. And I think the latest poll shows that 67% or so of Iranian Americans oppose this war. Inside of Iran, I think the signs have been even more clear, although it's not, we don't have reliable polls at this stage. But just anecdotally, it's very, very clear, I think, that people have turned dramatically, dramatically against this war. Even those who may have had a bit of a naive perspective of thinking that after Iraq, after Afghanistan, after Libya, after Syria, the United States, and on top of that, Israel, in the midst of its genocide, suddenly will bring up about democracy in Iran, I think has wakened up to the reality of what this war actually is.
And last question, and thank you again, Trita, for joining us. But the last question is, you know, there is two parts of this war. There's the interests of America, and then of course there's the interests of Israel. And we know from New York Times reporting that that Netanyahu made a case, probably the same case that he's made to multiple U.S. presidents prior, including Bush, Obama, Biden, and even Trump won. And that this time he was actually successful in convincing the president of moving forward with military action. There's two sets of interests. Now, the set of interests that's quite worrying, we know the U.S. set of interests and they keep changing, but the interest that many analysts have talked about and is quite worrying is that Israel is doing this not just because of nuclear weapons, not because they see Iran as an existential threat, but that they want to make sure that there is no one in that region, no nation, no country, no state in that region that can compete at all in any way, financially, militarily, academically, socially, with Israel, and they want to continue to maintain that edge in all aspects of life in the region. So that means they're essentially trying to set the country back generations. So it is not about the nuclear weapon. It is not about military advancement only. It is about any nation in that country, because now there's talks about Turkey and Turkey becoming the next Iran. Any nation in that region now is a threat to Iran if there's any level of advancement. Is that something that you see actually as Israel's goal, to make sure that they set Iran back generations and others in the region?
Absolutely. And I wrote about this actually 20 years ago in my book, Treacherous Alliance, which is based on a lot of interviews with Israeli and Iranian officials and US officials about their relationship. It's very clear that this is the strategy for security that Israel has. either because it's given up on the idea that it cannot make peace with its neighbors, or it doesn't want to pay the price for it, or it simply doesn't want it. Its strategy has been to keep everyone in its environment that is not dependent on the United States as weak as possible, so they cannot challenge Israel's ambitions for domination. Israel believes that security comes through dominations, not through the management of threat or through the establishment of peace. This is the reality of their military doctrine right now. And incidentally, it's also written into American law. This is part of the reason why the United States has a law that ensures that Israel has to have the strategic military edge in the region. No country in the region, no combination of countries in the region should be able to challenge Israel militarily. This is not a mystery. Frankly, it's not even a point of debate. It's just that now we are more clearly seeing how nakedly this means that Israel is going to be, its pursuit of this strategy means that it will establish a military hegemony in the region. And as a result, it will go to war on a regular basis against other countries in the region. And it will expect the United States to be a part of those wars, particularly when it comes to powerful states like Iran. And that raises the question for us here in the United States. Is this a strategy that serves U.S. interest? If Israel wants to choose its own strategy, that's one thing. Why should the United States have to go to war on Israel's behalf because of Israel's choice to pursue a strategy in which security is achieved not through peace, but through domination?
What you just heard were some of the remarks delivered at a press conference held on April 17, 2026, organized by the Muslim Public Affairs Council, releasing a new policy paper on the war on Iran titled The Pitfalls of Operation Epic Fury, How the Undeclared War Against Iran Hurts Americans' Interests Abroad and at Home. More information about the Muslim Public Affairs Council is at www.mpac.org, and you can find the full policy paper, The Pitfalls of Operation Epic Fury, posted on the organization's website, and I have also a link to it on our website, arabvoices.net. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. April 17th of each year marks Palestinian Prisoners' Day. It is usually dedicated to highlighting the plight of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners held in Israeli jails and advocating for their freedom, rights, and dignity. On April 17th, 2026, Doctors Against Genocide, a global coalition of healthcare workers dedicated to succeeding where global governments have failed in confronting genocide, held a press conference in Canada on Palestinian Prisoners' Day. I'm going to air the remarks delivered at that press conference, including the remarks of Maysa Hawash with Doctors Against Genocide, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician and president of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, Dr. Yiping Ji, Canadian physician, Dorothea Guchardo with GLIA Equal Care, and the remarks of Dr. Monica Mitra Chowdhury, Canadian physician with Health Workers Alliance for Palestine. Let's listen in first to Maysa Hawash with Doctors Against Genocide, followed by Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician and president of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society.
Today is Palestinian Prisoners' Day. But let's be clear, it should be called Palestinian Hostages' Day, because describing Palestinians as prisoners softens and obscures the criminal reality by which Palestinians are abducted, detained, tortured, and held without legal or medical access. These are not lawful detentions. These are acts of systemic violence. I stand before you not just as a health advocate, but as a Palestinian who has lived under apartheid, someone who has experienced firsthand the trauma of passing through checkpoints, dehumanized at every turn, who has watched neighbors disappear in the middle of the night, heard the sounds of raids on my neighbors' homes, the yelling and screaming of the so-called soldiers as they break into homes and abduct our sons and daughters. I have seen how fear becomes the air we breathe. Every single day, the world sees the evidence of what is happening. Right now, there are 350 Palestinian children detained in Israeli prisons. Children under 18 locked up in military facilities like Ofer and Megiddo. Are these just statistics, or are they children? Children who wake up every morning behind bars instead of being woken up by their mothers to get ready for school. Children who woke up as hostages for the sole crime of being Palestinian, for no reason other than breathing the air of their own homeland. Palestinian hostages are yet another manifestation of the ongoing, unrelenting genocide on the Palestinian people. Since October 2023, the number of Palestinian detainees has increased by 83%, from 50 to 150 to over 9,600 hostages. That is an 83% increase in arrests, abductions, detentions, and disappearances. And over 3,500 of those are held without charge or trial. Just disappeared because Israel says so. Nearly half of prisoners are held without any accountability. I'm not here, though, to talk about statistics. I want to talk about the architecture of fear, not random acts of violence, but a systemic, calculated infrastructure designed to break the human spirit. It begins with classification. Every day, children, mothers, fathers are forced to experience the brutal apartheid presence of Israel as they line up for hours, while soldiers determine who passes and who doesn't based on permits, IDs, and arbitrary rules. And as occupying forces raid neighborhoods and attack civilians for simply being there, we are separated, we are labeled, we are othered through deeply racist mechanisms that make humiliation routine. I have seen how this stress manifests in children, chronic anxiety and developmental delays that affect entire generations. It is by design. Next is systemic dehumanization. One thing is for sure, this is not about justice. It is about breaking people. Torture becomes standard practice, physical, psychological, and sexual. Humiliation is intentional. Basic humanity, food, water, and medical care is denied as a matter of policy. Our medical teams have documented prisoners whose conditions worsen and lead to death because treatment is deliberately withheld. Palestinian families are even ordered not to celebrate the release of their loved ones after months and years of detention. If they do, they are threatened with retaliation and rearrests, because joy has become an enemy of the apartheid state. Condition creation is central to this system of fear. When ambulances are delayed at checkpoints, when medications run out due to siege, when mobility restrictions prevent access to care, this is collective punishment designed to weaken entire populations. For Palestinians, the fear of losing loved ones has become ingrained in our DNA, because healing and life itself is not guaranteed. Just a few days ago, I was speaking to a friend of mine. She had spent 2 hours in absolute terror. She lives just 5 minutes away from Ramallah. Settlers protected by Israeli occupation forces stormed her village, attacked people, and stole around 180 cattle. She told me they were frozen with fear. For 2 hours, they did not dare move, close the windows, because they didn't want to attract any attention. She was worried for her 14-year-old boy, just because he was a Palestinian boy. And this is standard practice. In Palestine, arbitrary arrest and detention are not exceptions. They are the system. They manufacture fear, fracture families, and raise children to know their existence can be criminalized at any moment. When we say no Palestinian is safe, we are naming a reality built over decades, checkpoint by checkpoint, detention by detention. No Palestinian chose to live under this occupation, yet we are criminalized for the sheer act of living. This is why Doctors Against Genocide documents what others ignore, because we understand the architecture. Naming the architecture is the first step to dismantling it, because once you see the pattern, you can no longer claim ignorance. Standing here, though, on Parliament Hill fills me with apprehension. This government allows weapons to flow into Israel that kills my brothers and sisters, that kill our own children and children of people in Lebanon and Iran. It provides political and diplomatic cover and enables impunity. It offers empty words that manufacture consent for the killing and torture of my own people. Mr. Carney, how do you sleep at night knowing that your decisions and words provide the cover to allow genocide to continue? And now it is my absolute honor to introduce Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian physician and the president of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, who will speak to us on how this has become a codified policy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I greet everybody who's attending this press conference today. I think the story of Palestinian hostages, or prisoners, as they call them, is a very long one. As a matter of fact, since 1967, when we were occupied by the Israeli army, 1 million arrests took place. You can imagine, out of 5 million people, 1 million arrests during all these years. And today, it's not only that 9,500 people are put in most difficult conditions, including, as was said, 350 children and 73 women, but many of them are losing their lives. since October 7th due to torture, beating, mistreatment, starvation, and deprivation of medical care, we already lost 90 of our hostages in Israeli jails. And most recently, they've just passed a terrible law, a death penalty law against Palestinians. A death penalty law, which in my opinion is meant to justify and legalize the acts of killing against Palestinian hostages. We estimate that between 1,000 and 2,000 Palestinian prisoners in Gaza Strip were already field executed by the Israeli army. Not only the 90 people who were killed in Israeli jails, but also a huge number of people who were field executed. And we think that time will show how many of those people were really field executed. Now, in addition to that, this death penalty law is a very dangerous one. Imagine, it says if a Palestinian kills an Israeli, he will be subjected to death penalty. And this death penalty does not require even consensus of judges. And if it is, if somebody is judged to face death penalty, the execution has to take place by hanging in less than 90 days. And there is no possibility of re-examining such judgment. This law is the most racial and most discriminatory because it consolidates the system of apartheid. If a Palestinian kills an Israeli, he will be subjected to death penalty. If an Israeli kills a Palestinian, this law will not apply to them. So this is a further consolidation of the situation of two laws for two different people living on the same land. One civil law for Israelis and one military law for Palestinians. And the death penalty applies only to Palestinians. This is way beyond and much worse than the system of apartheid that prevailed in South Africa at one point of time. Because then nobody, even the apartheid system, did not dare to say that if a black man kills a white man, he will be assassinated and he will be hanged. But if a white man kills a black man, he will not be. That's a most discriminatory law. Second to that, this law shows how far fascism is growing. And you can imagine what happened in the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, when they celebrated the passing of this law by drinking glasses of champagne. They were celebrating passing the death penalty. And many of these Israeli members of Knesset were putting on their chests symbols of the ropes that will be used to hang Palestinians. This, in my opinion, is a reflection of how deep and far fascism has gone. To stop that, to change that, to reverse that, and to stop the suffering of Palestinian hostages in Israeli jails, we need more than just condemnations and statements of criticism. Condemnations do not affect Israel. Only if sanctions are imposed on the Israeli parliament for passing this law, only if Israel understands that the continuation of fascist behavior against Palestinian people and racist apartheid system, only if they understand that these systems will be met with sanctions and boycott, they will be affected, and they can these terrible things would stop. So please take measures. Tell the Israeli Knesset that it will be boycott unless it reverses this law of discrimination. Tell them that Israel will not receive military aid or military support or military equipment as long as it continues the system of occupation, apartheid, and genocide against the Palestinian people. Thank you.
That was Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician and president of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, speaking on Palestinian Prisoners' Day at a press conference organized by Doctors Against Genocide. Next, we will listen to the remarks of Dr. Yiping Ji, Canadian physician with Doctors Against Genocide, speaking at the same press conference.
I just returned from Barcelona, Spain, yesterday. I organized with a group called Canadian Boat to Gaza, which is part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition that has been sending boats to Gaza to challenge and ultimately break Israel's illegal siege and blockade on Gaza for the past 16 years. Seeing everyday people organize and mobilize is inspiring and hopeful, but it is deeply frustrating and infuriating to see that this work is even necessary. Because to end Israel's illegal siege and blockade on Gaza is the responsibility of the international community, specifically the responsibility of states and governments, including the Canadian government. Adorned on the boat sailing to Gaza included flags from many parts of the world, and of course, many Palestinian flags, to express solidarity with Palestine and Palestinians and their right to life, self-determination, existence, and their right to return to their traditional homelands. Also were flags calling for the release and freedom of Marwan Barghouti, who has been imprisoned by the Israeli military for 24 years. I'm also part of a group called Doctors Against Genocide, a global coalition of healthcare workers dedicated to succeeding where governments have failed in confronting genocide. Over a year ago, I was on a call with Doctors Against Genocide, and I got to hear directly from Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, as he shared updates from Kamal Adwan Hospital, of which he was the medical director of and where he worked as a pediatrician. He was taken hostage by the Israeli military in December 2024, over a year ago, and he remains in Israeli captivity because he stayed back in the hospital to care for his patients, for his people, and for his community. The Palestinian prisoner struggle for liberation is the Palestinian struggle for liberation. The Palestinian prisoner struggle for liberation is the heart of the Palestinian struggle for liberation. It is the most professional and ethical thing to do to call an end for genocide. It is the most human and humane thing to do to call for the freedom of people who are oppressed. Medical associations and other professional associations have largely, if not completely, failed to maintain equal respect for the right to life and freedom for Palestinians. This is a blatant act of dehumanization, and their silence demonstrates their complicity. While we stand here firmly, affirming Palestinians and their right to dignity and their right to life and freedom, including freedom for all the Palestinian hostages and prisoners and freedom from the torture and inhumane treatment they are subjected to by the Israeli military. Solidarity is the moral imperative. It is how we stay human in the face of immeasurable and unfathomable human trauma and suffering that is entirely preventable. Our solidarity is our response to an unjust reality and system of colonial domination and subjugation of Palestinians. The response of our Canadian government and our Canadian civil society will shape how we all perceive if one was on the right side of history by standing with Palestinian prisoners and with the oppressed in this world, or if one chooses to stand with the oppressors, the Israeli military and their government, who continue to commit mass atrocities, including the crime of genocide against Palestinians. I urge all members of Parliament and all members of the public in Canada to amplify Palestinian stories and their narratives, to support the Red Ribbon campaign, to support the international campaign to free all Palestinian political prisoners, and to support the Let Me Carry Your Voice project, amplifying Palestinian testimonies. I want to share with you testimony from someone who is my age in Gaza, a 31-year-old male arrested at Netzarim checkpoint, held for a total of 53 days, initially at the checkpoint before being transferred to an unknown military camp and the Negev prison. He was interviewed 151 days after his release. I was hoping that the next morning would come and I would die. I really hoped to die. The reality of the strikes made me feel extremely humiliated, especially given my high status in the neighborhood and at home. Imagine telling your family and friends what happened to you. I was severely beaten by one of the soldiers, resulting in 3 broken ribs in my chest. The pain is still all over my body and I cannot move or stand. The scars from the plastic ties are still on my hands. Whenever I look at them, I remember what happened to me inside the detention center and how helpless I was, unable to even defend myself. From time to time, I also feel pain in my chest from the fracture I suffered. His story and countless others are available to read in a report titled Torture and Genocide: The Shattered Futures of Former Palestinian Detainees in Gaza, written by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Ample other reports are available by various human rights organizations. Learn their stories. Speak up, organize, mobilize, and act. History is watching us. We are calling for an immediate release of all Palestinian hostages and political prisoners, including healthcare workers. An end to administrative detention, torture, and medical abuse. Immediate access to legal representation, family visits, healthcare, and adequate water, food, and hygiene for all prisoners. An end to Canada's complicity in Israeli occupation and genocide.
That was Dr. Yiping Ji, Canadian physician with Doctors Against Genocide. Let's listen next to the remarks of Dorothea Gochardo with Glia Equal Care.
When someone shows you who they are, believe them. Israel shows itself to be a state fueled by hatred for Palestinian life. It shows us that this hatred can activate a violence so unrestrained that the term genocide feels insufficient. This isn't an accolade to be celebrated. And yet celebrate is exactly what members of the Israeli regime did when they passed a death penalty law reserved exclusively for Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. Prison is an interesting term. I bet that most Canadians associate the term prison with criminal. that if someone is in prison, they deserve to be there because they've done something seriously wrong. Prisons are a predictable feature of our society. We've collectively agreed, through precedent or lack of imagination, that prisons must exist to punish those who grievously transgress our laws. And so when we hear the term prison, we've been trained to think criminal. The Palestinians in prison force us to rethink that assumption. Right now, there are 9,600 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. These include men, women, and children, all of whom were taken by a system that is reserved exclusively for Palestinians. Israelis are not subject to this system. There is no standard of evidence. And even within this deeply unfair system, the Israeli government hasn't even bothered to charge the majority of those detainees with any crime, showing how flimsy the veneer really is on Israel's racist, unjust carceral apparatus. Despite not having been charged with anything at all, being in the prison system means that they are subject to a significant amount of abuse that has been well documented by human rights organizations, journalists, and the victims themselves. They are routinely beaten, starved, and raped by both soldiers and by dogs. And when they cannot speak, their bodies tell us the story. In October of last year, the Israeli regime released roughly 1,700 hostages from their prisons. Some of those released were unidentified corpses, people from Gaza, stolen from their homes, off the street, from hospitals, held without charge, with no ability to communicate with loved ones or legal counsel, and killed in myriad brutal ways. My staff was present on the ground in Gaza to receive those bodies and reported back that they were clearly mutilated. Some bodies had their hands tied and put behind their backs. They were in distorted positions with obvious signs of torture. Many had fingers cut off. One man had his head smashed in. Many, too many, were so badly brutalized that it was nearly impossible to identify the bodies. It must be said very clearly, Israel returned these bodies mutilated and with obvious signs of torture because they knew that they could get away with it. Over and over again, the world has turned away from Israel's war crimes. As a signatory to several international conventions, including the Convention Against Torture and the Geneva Conventions, the Canadian government is compelled to speak out against the systemic abuse of Palestinians being held hostage in Israeli prisons. Further, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights explicitly requires that all persons deprived of their liberty be treated with humanity and respect for their inherent dignity. Canada's ratification of that covenant means that we must advocate for these standards globally, not just within our own borders. Canada has previously stated that it is, quote, deeply concerned by reports on the torture and abuse of Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, including sexual violence. Although it recognizes that no such treatment is ever justifiable in any context, it has taken no meaningful action to intervene, to follow words with action, and hold Israel accountable for its egregious systemic abuses. It is to our eternal shame as a nation that we have not pursued every avenue to liberate Palestinian prisoners from the inhumanity of their Israeli gulags. Today, we ask the government to end our shame and act now to free Palestinians and to free Palestine.
That was Dorothea Guchardo with GLIA Equal Care speaking on Palestinian Prisoners Day at a press conference organized by Doctors Against Genocide. Dr. Monica Mitra-Chowdhury, Canadian physician with Health Workers Alliance for Palestine, also spoke at that press conference. Let's listen to her remarks.
Did you know that Israeli doctors participate in the torture of Palestinian healthcare workers and the Canadian government supports it? Today, on Palestinian Prisoners Day, we call for an end to the torture and the immediate release of all Palestinian political prisoners. I'm a general surgeon, and I'm speaking on behalf of Health Workers Alliance for Palestine. In September 2025, I traveled to Gaza, and I saw firsthand the torture and genocide that occurs in Palestine at the hands of Israel. Israel controls all borders, creating a catastrophic lack of food, water, and shelter. It's one of the few places in the world where you can be turned away at the border for bringing in life-saving medications or equipment. Israel deliberately destroys infrastructure, roads, sanitation facilities, power grids, in an attempt to kill and make Gaza unlivable. And Canada continues to provide Israel with diplomatic support, technology, and weapons, despite mendacious claims to the contrary. We demand an end to this active collaboration in Israel's genocide in Palestine. Israeli prisons are a microcosm of the broader system of Zionist settler colonialism. There are 9,600 Palestinians held captive in Israeli prisons, as you've heard already. They're handcuffed, blindfolded, zip-tied, 24/7 for months at a time, even years. No due process, no lawyers. We demand an end to this abhorrent system and immediate access to lawyers, family visits, food, water, and hygiene. And Israel specifically targets the healthcare system, besieging and bombing hospitals to kill, injure, and prevent life-saving care. Their message is deliberate. Nowhere is safe. And yet Palestinian health workers have continued to excel in their fields, as I've seen myself. Under siege, they provide highly specialized care. Beneath bombs, they train the next generation of medical professionals. For this, they have been targeted for decades. And the targeting of health workers is an early warning sign of genocide. Dr. Issam Abu Ajwa, a senior general surgeon, was performing emergency general surgery when Israeli soldiers dragged him out of the operating room and took him into detention. Interrogators were instructed to damage his hands so that he could no longer perform surgery. In the past 2.5 years, 1,722 healthcare workers have been killed, hundreds detained, and close to 100 remain in captivity today. We have grave concerns for their safety. 6 prominent healthcare workers have already been killed in detention due to torture, starvation, and medical neglect. And as you've already heard, Israel passed a law that turns this killing into official state policy. This is genocide behind bars. We must act now to stop administrative detention, torture, medical abuse, and mass execution. But despite systemic targeting, Palestinian health workers persist. Hospitals, clinics are rebuilt. 168 Palestinian medical students recently graduated in front of Al-Shifa Hospital. And after his release, Dr. Abu Ajwa said, "Even if my body is torn apart, I will continue to perform surgery, heal my patients, and serve my people as long as I'm alive." As healthcare workers, we demand freedom for our colleagues and all political prisoners.
That was Dr. Monica Mitra Chowdhury, Canadian physician with Health Workers Alliance for Palestine, speaking at a press conference organized by Doctors Against Genocide. For more information about Doctors Against Genocide, visit doctorsagainstgenocide.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.